You are listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment, a podcast brought to you by Migrants Organise. Throughout this series, we hope to shine a light on the realities of the UK's immigration and asylum system, explore the pressure and anguish it puts upon people who go through it, while also hearing about hopeful and powerful acts of migrants and community organising. Each episode will focus on a different aspect of the UK's asylum system. On today's episode, I am joined by Agnes, Carenza and Gemma from Women for Refugee Women. Women for Refugee Women is an organisation that empowers refugee and asylum seeking women to speak out, become leaders and advocate for change. We talked about the arbitrary nature of the UK's detention system and its similarities to a prison you can be sent to without trial. Agnes shared her personal experiences inside Yarl's Wood and amazing campaigning work around Derwentside Detention Centre. We discussed the expense, cruelty and hypocrisy at the heart of detention and some of the ways Women for Refugee Women support people. Listeners should be aware this episode contains discussion of suicide, trauma and other mental health conditions. Hello everybody. Today I am joined by Gemma, Carenza and Agnes from Women for Refugee Women. Hello everybody, how are we doing?
Good,
thanks very much. Hello.
Hi, good.
I wondered if you could all just quickly introduce yourselves and tell me a little bit about Women for Refugee Women.
I can kick us off. So my name's Carenza and I'm the communications manager at Women for Refugee Women. And we're a London-based charity supporting refugee and asylum seeking women to rebuild their lives and speak out and advocate for change and to campaign for a fairer asylum system. And I'll hand over to Gemma.
Thanks, Carenza. Yeah, so my name's Gemma. I'm the policy and research manager at Women for Refugee Women. And for a long time now, ever since I joined Women for Refugee Women, actually, I've been working on our campaign to end the use of immigration detention for women. And I'll hand over to Agnes.
Thank you, Gemma. I'm Agnes. I'm the spokesperson at Women for Refugee Women. I was an asylum seeker for 8 years. I just got my status of refugee. Yeah.
Thanks, all. It's great to have you here. So a lot of people don't really know about immigration detention. Could one of you tell me a little bit more about it? So first, what is immigration detention?
I'll start with that, if that's okay. It's a good question. What is immigration detention? I mean, immigration detention, I guess one of the first things to say about it is that it's an administrative or civil process. So it's not part of the criminal justice system. And what that means is that in terms of how people are detained, the decision making around who is detained, you know, it lies in the hands of a civil servant. So there's no, in terms of the decision for someone to go into detention, it doesn't go before a court or a judge or anything like that. It's a civil servant who makes the decision to detain someone. I suppose the other thing to say about immigration detention is that the government would say that the reason for immigration detention, you know, is that it's to remove people from the UK. You know, we need immigration detention to manage it, to manage migration, and that's its kind of purpose. That's what it's there to do. But we know actually in practice what happens is that very few people who are detained are actually removed from the UK. The vast majority, and actually a really significant vast majority of the moment, of people who are locked up in immigration detention centres are ultimately released back into the community to carry on with their immigration cases.
Thank you, Gemma. So who tends to get detained?
It's a real range of people. I mean, certainly, you know, obviously Women for Refugee Women works specifically with women seeking asylum in the UK, and people who are seeking asylum can be detained. I mean, they can be detained first of all on arrival in the UK. You know, recently we've spoken to an increasing number of women who've arrived in the UK by boat and have literally been detained as soon as they've arrived in the UK. If you're as someone seeking asylum, you can also be detained if you once you've gone through the asylum process, and if your claim has been refused and you've become so-called appeal rights exhausted. There are also people who will have been in prison before, who've served criminal sentences, and then who the government will try to deport following those criminal sentences. Again, we speak to, and what I would really emphasize about that is that there isn't a clear distinction between people seeking asylum and people who've been in prison. Very often these categories are very, you know, they're not discrete categories. There are overlaps there. And so we've certainly worked with, you know, women seeking asylum who might have been prosecuted for documents offences, who've been locked up in prison, and then the Home Office will try and deport them following that. Or women who've been trafficked to the UK, who might have been criminalised for offences relating to their exploitation, who are then, who are put in prison, but then who the Home Office will try to deport following that. I mean, the other thing, and I think Agnes will want to come in after that, but the other thing that I would just say is that in terms of who is detained at the moment, there are about 2,000 people in immigration detention overall in the UK. Women make up a relatively small proportion of those people, well, actually a very small proportion of those people in detention. So at the moment, the most recent statistics show that there were about seven that there were 75 women in immigration detention at the end of June this year. And that's important for us to understand. I think, first of all, in terms of the really small numbers of women in detention, it really shows that actually the use of detention for women could be ended immediately. There are such small numbers of women in detention at the moment. But also, it's really important to understand that they make up a minority of people in detention, because that means that very often women's particular experiences in detention might be overlooked, because, you know, because they are a minority in detention. I'm going to hand over to Agnes now because I think she wants to come in.
The thing that I can say is simply that anyone who apply for asylum can be arrested anytime. Is why when the women are going to report, they're scared, because the letter that they give you to go for the reporting say that you are liable to be detained anytime. So you don't know when you will be detained, but anytime you can be detained because you are an asylum seeker. Okay.
And when you say go to report, do you have to go and report every week?
It depends on, I will say, the person that you meet. But some people go every week, some 2 weeks, some a month, some even 6 months. I went through all before getting detained. I was going to report in Manchester, Dallas Court every week. Then after, when I was released from detention, for 5 years, 5 years, I went to report every week, then once a month, until I got my status. But it depend on, I don't know what is the bias, but it's when you go to report, they say, oh, next time come in 1 month time.
And how long are people normally detained for?
When I was in detention, I met some people are released after 1 week. Me, I stayed there for over 3 months, and I found people there. One was 8 months, one more than a year. The thing is not like a criminal sentence that they can tell you will be detained for 2 years, 6 months, you don't know. You don't know. Jim, I want to come in.
Yeah, I mean, I think Exactly, you know, what Agnes has just said there. And I think that's, you know, one of the really important things to know about immigration detention in the UK, is that there is no time limit. There's no statutory time limit on immigration detention in the UK. And what that means, you know, as Agnes has explained, is that you know, you people simply don't know how long they're going to be held for. And so, you know, yeah, we've and Agnes has said this as well, you know, we've certainly worked with women, you know, who've been held for really significant periods of times, you know, for months on end, sometimes, you know, for up to or even over a year. I think that one of the things that I would kind of also say is that that even for women who've been held for what might be seen as relatively short periods, because when they're detained, they don't know how long they're going to be detained for. That's incredibly traumatic. You know, you just don't know. You don't know that you're only, you know, that you're only going to be there for a few days. You know, potentially it could go on for a very long time. There is one we do have, although we don't, there isn't a statutory time limit on immigration detention in the UK. There is for one particular group of women, there is actually a time limit. So for women who are pregnant, there is now a time limit on detention, on their detention of 72 hours, which is something that was brought in 2016, and which we and other organisations like Medical Justice really campaigned very hard for. And one of the really important things that you see from that, apart from the fact, of course, we don't think that anyone should be in detention at all because it is so traumatic, but one of the really important things that we've seen from that, is that that time limit has meant that the number of pregnant women going into detention has significantly fallen. You know, it's fallen by over 50%. And that's because, you know, the Home Office's decision-making powers, their discretion has been severely curtailed, which is a really, really important thing because actually their decision-making is so arbitrary, and so random, you know, that there need to be, you know, really, really, really clear limits on that.
Thanks, Gemma. Well done on that campaigning victory. Hopefully, we'll be able to come back to that a little bit later on. Agnes, I wanted to turn back to you. I wondered if you could tell us a bit about what it was like inside detention.
I always said that I don't see the difference between prison and detention because for me, detention is a prison. So all the restrictions that you have in the prison is what you meet in detention. You don't have the choice of your meal. You don't have you have a time that you should go to sleep, the check-in, what else? You cannot go out in Yazwood. There is no Yazwood is far from the city, and there is no I will say space that even you can get from your room and go and walk around to say that I'm going to walk around and come back. So it's a prison for me. It's a prison. It's a prison. You have to queue to walk. Wash your clothes. You have to off the light at 9. You have to be at a breakfast at a certain time. Everything is a schedule. You don't have any freedom to do what you want to do. The prison.
Are you able to meet other people who are in detention?
The people who are in detention, yeah, you can meet them. You can meet them at the where you have food. The canteen can meet them there, or you can. I was in a shared room, so I have roommates, and also I was learning English there. So for people who want to learn English, you can go to the class. But most of people are so traumatized that they stay in the room; they don't go get out from the room. But for 3 months, for 1 year, you are not going to stuck on your room. So yeah, going to continue, we'll meet someone. But how long? Because the time limit for eating is also there.
So what, while you were in detention, what did a typical day look like?
I don't have the time, the table in my head, but there is a time in the morning to go for the breakfast. If you miss it, you miss it. After that, you come to your room. If you want to join English class, that you can go to English class or craft class. So after the breakfast, you wait until the time of lunch. You go to the lunch and you come back to your room and you wait until dinner time, and you go, no one will come and ask you why you don't go to this activity or this. You can stay in your room all day if you want, is what make people so distressed. And
Thank you for sharing that, Agnes. So what you've described sounds very like a prison. You've got very little control over what you do all day. But what you were saying before, Gemma, is that it's a prison that you can go to just on the decision of a civil servant. So there's no court system. It's not a criminal, not part of the criminal justice system. Returning to what you were saying about how you can end up there for very arbitrary reasons. Agnes, how has your experience being detained affected you or other people that you know?
I always feel emotional when I talk about this time, because when I was coming in this country, I was expecting protection, not a prison. And I was asking myself why I'm in prison. Did I make something wrong asking for protection or sanctuary? So this part, I'm still, I would say, angry with myself, but also with the people who deal with the system, because we are here because we fled some for some reason. I fled a civil war, and so I have still this. I'm not healed from that. And also, when I was there, I saw one young girl, over 18. She, I think, less than 20, that tried to kill herself to make a suicide. She was forced to marriage, and she didn't want that. So there's people who are not strong, who are, don't have hope, and since you don't know how long you will stay there, they try to kill themselves. The mental health is a big issue there. You don't have someone who will come and ask you, how do you feel? Can we help? You don't have someone like that. The only people who are, you meet are the guard visiting your room, getting your in your room, with even not knocking at your door, but check if you are in with the key that can open all the doors. You lost your dignity, everything that you ask yourself, I'm a human being, or who am I? Who am I?
Thank you for sharing that, Agnes. So the people who are the staff at Jarlswood, are they, so you just said that they're not very supportive. How did they treat the people who were in detention?
For me, I didn't have any link with the people. I will say the people working in there. My connection was more with the detainees, so I didn't receive any help from when they call you is to say that, okay, to hand to me, here is your letter that you will be deported in 2 days or thing like that. But they are not supportive. They are doing their job, maybe they are doing their job, but they are not there to make you happy, to make you feel strong, to make you think that you will get out or anything. For me, there was no useful for, to me. They were not useful for.
I was just going to raise, and I'm sure Gemma will be able to add something else to this as well, that there was an undercover report done several years ago, back in 2015 at Yarlswood, which showed a high level of disrespectful language used by guards towards people who were detained there, like a high level of contempt for them. There was also quite like violent language used, and yeah, just a lot of incidences basically where the staff were treating people in a disrespectful and inappropriate way. And our own research has also uncovered some incidences of this. And I'll hand over to Gemma, who I'm sure will have something to say on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, when Yarlswood isn't the main detention centre for women anymore. That's now Derwentside. But while it was still the main detention centre for women, we did a report in 2015 called I Am Human, which looked very much at the conditions for women there and the way that women were treated in Yarlswood. And this really comes back to the point about the particular experiences of women in detention, because one of the things that we found is that, you know, first of all, the majority of women in detention are survivors of gender-based violence, including, you know, rape, domestic violence, forced marriage, have been through very traumatic experiences already. And what we found in Yarlswood in terms of the treatment of the women there is that very often male staff were seeing women in really intimate and inappropriate situations. So, for instance, when women are put on what's known as constant supervision, or you know, what might also be referred to as suicide watch, what happens is that a guard watches them literally the whole time. Like they're constantly watched by a guard. And so, you know, what we found was happening in Yarlswood is that male guards were being used for that constant supervision. So they were watching women, you know, while they were in the shower, while they were going to the toilet, while they were getting undressed, while they were sleeping in their room. And when we released this research, initially the Home Office said, no, this isn't happening at all, completely untrue. And then subsequently the prisons inspectorate went into Yarlswood and found that it absolutely was happening. The Home Office brought in guidance after that that says that, you know, for instance, male staff shouldn't be used in those sorts of situations. And things certainly seem to sort of improve to an extent in Yarlswood. But I think it's just a really important example of the trauma of detention, first of all, and the way that detention and the things that women are subjected to in detention really exacerbate the trauma that they have already been through. But also just in terms of the Home Office's denials initially of what was going on. And then it's only when the prisons inspectorate come in and say, yes, this is definitely happening, that they acknowledge it is. Just the obfuscation and the lack of transparency of the Home Office, and just their refusal to acknowledge that this is such a harmful system that should just never exist in the first place.
Yes, I really hear what you're saying there. So, Agnes, you talked about somebody trying to kill themselves while they were in Yarlswood. I wondered if you could tell us a bit more about access to mental health services in detention and health services in general.
In detention, I didn't know that there were a mental health session. That means that when you go there, maybe the induction is not done properly. It's not done properly. The only thing that I know that there is, maybe I call it surgery, but there is a room that when you feel sick, you go there and you meet the nurse or someone there. But for the mental health, explain to people what is the mental health, what we can receive from them as advice or things like that. I didn't. I cannot talk for everyone, because if there were these services, this help, the young lady will not go through. They're watching people from their camera. How you can leave a young lady try to kill herself? That means that you are not conscious or concerned by what can happen to the detainee, is what I think. I didn't comment this, profiter. I didn't benefit from this service because I didn't know that he was there. They didn't tell me when they were doing the induction, giving me my prisoner stuff. They didn't tell me that.
So yeah, I mean, I think, first of all, as as Agnes has said, formally there are health services in immigration detention, including mental health services, but women might not necessarily be aware of that or how to access it. I think the other thing that's really important to know is that there have been, consistently really serious concerns around raised about the quality of health services in detention, organizations like Medical Justice have really documented the serious failings, in the provision of healthcare in detention. One of the things that we have heard from many of the women that we have spoken to, and I think I know that Agnes, you have talked about this before as well, is what's often referred to as the culture of disbelief. And we talk about the culture of disbelief in relation to the asylum system and asylum decision making. You very much see it in health services and detention as well, and this idea that very often, women have said to us that the response they get is that, you're not really that ill, and that actually health services think that women are kind of putting it on because they don't want to be deported from the UK. And so this constant level of suspicion and questioning of about, whether your health problems are genuine or not. And the final thing that I would really say about health services, and particularly mental health services and detention, is that the fact of locking someone up, of depriving someone of their liberty, without any time limit, locking people up indefinitely, it's such a traumatic thing that, however, even if health services were really good in detention, that doesn't that's that they're never going to be able to address the fact that detention is inherently harmful. And so, they're always going to be inadequate because the harm of detention itself is just so enormous. Detention in itself causes trauma, it re-traumatizes people.
Thank you both. Gemma, you mentioned at the beginning that the government says that detention is necessary for immigration enforcement and for managing immigration, even if it might be awful for people going through it. What do you guys say to that?
I mean, obviously, we profoundly disagree with that. That's probably no surprise to anyone. I mean, I think, kind of one of the first things that we would say about that is that, like I said at the beginning, the Home Office has kind of persistently, and the government persistently justify their use of immigration detention by saying it's necessary, yeah, in order to manage migration and to remove people from the UK. But we know that on those like even according to what the Home Office says about immigration detention, like it doesn't work in that way in practice. Like it just doesn't do what they say it's necessary for. And so, the majority of people who are locked up in detention are not removed from the UK. They're released back into the community to carry on with their cases. And certainly for women, and particularly for women seeking asylum, those figures are very, very high. So the most recent statistics show that in the previous year, in 2021, 92% of asylum seeking women leaving detention left detention not to be removed from the UK, but to be released back into the community to carry on with their cases. So just a tiny proportion of those asylum seeking women were removed from the UK. So clearly, like as I said, on the government's own terms, it's a failure. It doesn't do what they say it's there to do.
For me, the detention is not necessary. As Gemma said before, most of the women detained come back from detention. And when you come back from detention, they will ask you, where are you going to live? And most of people go to live in the community. So why not let those people going to live in the community? The other thing that is for me is n not necessary is the cost. If I'm wrong, but Jim, I think it's nearly £100 a day for one person detained, when they give £5 a week for someone who outside. So for me, it's a waste of money of the government and waste of time and traumatizing process for asylum seeker. And I will even say that for me, putting people in detention is like a modern slavery, because you use those people to give business to people who are working with you in this detention.
Yeah, absolutely. And just I'm to say, yeah, Agnes, you're absolutely right on that statistic there in terms of it costing £100 a day to hold one person in immigration detention. I think the only thing that I would add to that in terms of the cost is that the Home Office also pays out millions in compensation to people who've been unlawfully detained every year. So that adds to the waste, like the huge amounts of money that are spent on this traumatizing and completely unnecessary policy. So last year, the government paid out over £9 million in compensation because of unlawful detention. And those are the only the unlawful detention claims that are actually brought. There are many more people who have been unlawfully detained who aren't going to bring, who won't bring those compensation claims. So it's really, it's probably far more that they should be paying out, but it really gives you a sense of a scale of the just the waste of public money of this policy.
I was just going to add, as Gemma said, the government's stated intentions of detention are to remove people from the UK, but in actual fact, it is just another part of their wider hostile environment, which is designed to keep people in a situation of poverty. It makes people destitute, it's cruel, it's hostile by design, and this is very purposefully done by the government. And it also causes, as Agnes said earlier, the fear and the anxiety and the stress and the mental health impact it has on people. This is all very purposeful, and it's something that the government themselves has acknowledged that detention is harmful. And the continuation of this is just to create this hostile environment, maintain this hostile environment, and keep people in a really awful situation. And I think, as Gemma said and Agnes has said, obviously we want the use of detention to be ended altogether. And it is much more humane and correct that people can continue their cases in their communities and build a foundation, build community, be with their friends and family and loved ones. And this is just another instance of the government keeping people out of this form of society and preventing people from integrating.
I just wanted to quickly cycle back to something that Agnes mentioned, which is, Agnes, you said that you thought that the detention system was run in many ways quite like a business and it was a way of people making money. So I know that some of the detention centres are run by private companies like G4S. I wondered if you could tell me a little bit more about what you meant about feeling like it was run like a business.
It's a business, because when you see how much they pay to Mighty, to G4S, for to Sodexo, and when you compare to the help, the support that they give it to asylum seeker, the asylum seeker got is around 35 a week, and you pay £100 a day for someone in prison. Where is going all this money? So for me, it's a business. Business better Home Office and the society, the company like Mighty, like Sodexo, like G4S. For me, it's a business. And unfortunately, they are using the life of people to do this business, using people to do this business. And this is really awful. It's wicked. It's not good. It's not good.
I think that that's a really good point, Agnes. If you look at obviously very small amounts of money, which people going through the asylum system are entitled to spend on their day-to-day lives, often pushing people into poverty, compared to the amount of money which the government is willing to throw at these companies that run detention centres where people are treated very badly and there aren't good services there. I think that is a really, really good point to bring up. Obviously, when we're talking about alternatives to government policy, there's loads of different options which we could look at. But for you, what would you say is a better way that the government could think about, like, right now?
For me, the best way is to let people stay in with the community. The first time that I visited this country, it was in 1997. I love it. In summer, I love the flowers everywhere. And then in 2003, I sent two of my children to study here. And in 2011, the civil war happened in my country. And I have to go somewhere. And it's only here that I can come because I have a visa who is not expired. I came here because I thought that I could stay with my daughter or my son. And my visa was going to expire, and I don't want to be illegal in this country. So I went to say, here is my situation. And they advised me to apply for asylum. So most of people coming here have somewhere to stay. They have a proof of address. Let them stay in the community with their parents or something like that. Is the first thing that I can say. And that I said before, if you let them stay with your community, you will save money. Government will save to do better thing. When I was released from detention, they asked me, where are you going to live? I was living in my community. So why not let me living in my community at the beginning? Why not? You are not going to deport all the asylum seekers. Let them find a job and work and pay taxes and use the money that you spend in detention to build as a business that can bring some income to the country.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I completely agree with what Agnes has said there, you know, that really in so many ways, in terms of what is a better way, that there's just a very straightforward answer that, you know, that people should be allowed to live in the community and be part of their communities, you know, while their cases are being resolved. And I think, you know, one of the things that I flagged up earlier was that at the moment there are, you know, there has been a significant drop in the number of women in detention over the past sort of 4 years or so. It has started to increase slightly more recently, but at the moment, you know, there are about 75 women in detention, and that really is just such a small number. And what that means is that actually ending the Home Office, the government could literally end the detention of women today. Like, that is absolutely a practical possibility. And I think, you know, just I think another thing that shows that it very much is a practical possibility is that the government, the Home Office itself, has started, you know, did start to explore this a couple of years ago. In 2019, they started an alternative to detention pilot for women seeking asylum, which was based in Newcastle, ironically, not that far away from where Derwentside, the new detention centre for women, was subsequently opened. For reasons completely unknown to us, the Home Office then decided to abandon that pilot and hasn't done any further work on that. But, you know, the very fact that they started this pilot shows that they acknowledge that there is another way, that detention doesn't have to exist, and people could be can live in the community while their cases, you know, while their cases are being resolved.
And I was just going to add that I think it's important to take it back to like basics of, we know that the most of the women that we support in our network have fled torture, gender and sexual based violence, war, conflict, many horrendous things, and they have come here looking for safety and seeking protection. And I think we have to question why the government continue to then use detention, which they have themselves acknowledged as being extremely harmful and detrimental to women's physical and mental health. So it's just looking to a kinder and fairer and more welcoming system that's based on believing women rather than this culture of disbelief that is so dominating at the moment.
Fantastic. Thank you all. Karenza, I just wanted to come back to you. Do you think you'd be able to tell me a bit more about the work that you do with Women for Refugee Women?
Yes. Yeah, so we're based in London, but we do have women that come to us from across the UK. So we work in lots of different ways. So we have lots of empowerment activities and creative and educational activities for refugee and asylum seeking women. These range from lots of different things, such as English classes. We have a radical knitting group, a drama group, yoga classes. And these are all based around, you know, forming solidarity between refugee and asylum seeking women, letting them build friendships and meet other women who understand what they've been through, and also being able to develop their skills and confidence to then go on to do whatever they want to do with their lives. It's all about women having choice. So whether this is to become campaigners and advocates within our network, campaigning to MPs or to the public, or whether it's to pursue their goals of education or employment. Then aside from our empowerment activities, we do lots of like influencing work, which is designed to either change the views of the public and tell refugee women's stories through the media, through events on social media, through creative projects to basically explain to people what it is to be a refugee woman, what it means, tell their stories and sort of change minds, change hearts. And then this leads to our work to try and influence the parliamentarians, which is increasingly difficult at the moment with how hostile the government is, but ultimately to try and create change to have a fairer and more welcoming asylum system for women seeking safety. I mean, our overall aim is that these women can find safety here and begin to rebuild their lives and live their lives the way they want with protection.
Yes, and I'm one of the products of the work that Women for Refugee Women is doing. I will say that I met them in 2014, and I couldn't say a word in English because my first language is French. But they gave me the opportunity to look in me and see what I'm able to bring to I will say this society or my sisters who are going through asylum seeking process and today I can express, maybe I always say that my English is not good, but when I talk, people can understand the essential things that I want to say. And also I can stand in front of people and speaking is with Women for Refugee Women, that I went to the parliament meeting the MPs and tell them, here is our issue, our concern. And now I'm standing as a spokesperson against detention, campaigning against detention. So I got all this confidence because Women for Refugee Women was there, is there to support me to move on and bring the little that I can bring to my sisters, to the society.
That's fantastic. So Women for Refugee Women has a campaign called Set Her Free, which is against Derwent Side Detention Centre, and there's a legal challenge as well. Could you, this is a question for all of you, could you all tell me a bit more about this?
Yeah, so I can start us off. So as I said earlier on, Yarswood used to be the main detention centre for women, and then it was, in the Home Office's own terms, repurposed, and is now a detention centre for men. At that point, we hoped that, that, like I said, the numbers of women in detention were so small. We were obviously strongly advocating that there shouldn't be another detention centre for women, but the Home Office subsequently decided to open Derwentside Detention Centre, which is in County Durham. It's about 20 minutes away from the city of Durham, in a very, very remote and difficult to get to location. And so, because we focus on the detention of women, our campaigning, the Set Her Free campaign, really now is focused on initially trying to stop it from opening, but then, when it opened, of course, our focus has now shifted to trying to shut it down. We did launch a legal challenge against again, a legal challenge against the Home Office focused on Derwentside, which was specifically about the provision of legal advice there, to women detained there, and the inadequacies of that. But really, our ultimate aim in terms of bringing that challenge was not that we wanted, that we think conditions in detention can get better. We don't believe that that's possible. There's no such thing as good detention. We very much brought that legal challenge, to try and shut down Derwentside. And I think, unfortunately, that legal challenge wasn't successful. But what's been so positive to see in terms of the campaigning against Derwentside is the legal challenge has been very much just one part of the wider campaign to shut down Derwentside. And there is an incredible there are some incredible local groups who have been campaigning against Derwentside, even before it opened, who continue to campaign now. And we have been so, I think we felt really, privileged to be able to work with those local groups, with the local campaigners who are so dedicated and committed, and like I said, the legal challenge has just been one part of that campaign. There are regular protests at the site, so much organizing and mobilizing around this campaign. And maybe, I don't know, Agnes, if you want to say a bit more about the kind of protests, because you've spoken at so many of them, and kind of, yeah, that sort of stuff.
I don't know really what to say, but our goal is to end the detention. And since Home Office break his promises, we should stand to remind them that you said that you will not open any more a detention center. So it's the first purpose. Purpose and the intention. What, as Gemma said, the people there are against this detention in the counties. They don't want it. But unfortunately, I think the government doesn't listen to his citizens. So they keep on every Saturday, they go there, and the last. The third, Gemma, the third Saturday of every month, they are also there. We attend many of those detention, this campaign against detention. The last time that we went there is the national one on the 15th of October. The thing is, we will campaign until we have we obtain the end of immigration detention. I will say that I'm always thankful for two people who stand against this thing, that they know that it doesn't bring anything to the country. It destroys life of people, breaking families. And so we keep on, and I hope soon we'll get everyone free, every woman free for the detention.
Yeah, so as Agnes says, and just to give a quick kind of plug for the protests and the local groups organizing it, so on the third Saturday of every month and between 12 and 2, outside Derwentside, the three local groups involved in campaigning against it, No to Hassockfield, Abolish Detention Hassockfield, and Durham People's Assembly organize a protest. And the numbers have been growing over months. It's just a really important show of solidarity. With the women who are detained there, and to continue campaigning against, Derwentside being opened.
Fantastic. So I think probably the big question that listeners will be asking is how can they support all of this amazing work?
Yeah, so there's a couple of different things people can do. So the first one is we have a specific fundraiser, which is to support women who are currently detained in Derwentside Detention Centre. For these women, Derwentside is in a really remote area of the country, and it's extremely difficult for their friends and family to visit because of this, which means they're often quite isolated and unable to get the money that they'd usually get from their friends or family to be able to buy things that they need themselves in the centre. So the money that we will raise from this will directly go to support these women who are currently detained in Derwentside. So it's a really tangible thing that people can donate to, and they know that they're making a real difference to these women who are isolated from their loved ones and from society at the moment. We also have, Agnes can speak about it a bit more, I'm sure, but she launched a petition last year, and it now has, I think, over 15,000 signatures. It could be more, which is to call for Derwentside to be shut down, which would be great if people could add their name to that and share it on social media too. And otherwise, it'd be really great if people could just follow Women for Refugee Women on social media. Our handle is the number four and Refugee Women on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And we post a lot about our campaign against detention, and more specifically, Derwentside Detention Centre on there, which is also where we'll share things from the local groups that Gemma mentioned that are involved in the local protests. Agnes or Gemma, do you have anything you'd like to add?
No, you put that perfectly.
We will share links for all of these things in the notes of the show. So do look below this episode and find ways that you can get involved. Well, Gemma, Carenza, and Agnes, thank you all so much for joining me today. Have you got any final thoughts that you'd like to share before we head off?
No, thank you. Thank you very much, Luke, for that.
Thank you very much. You are the spokesperson for the voiceless. So thank you for having us.
That's very kind, Agnes. Well, thank you so much for speaking out and for sharing your story and for sharing your thoughts. I think it's been really, really great chatting to you today. Hope you have a brilliant rest of your week and hopefully speak to you soon. You have been listening to Losing Myself, Mental Health in a Hostile Environment. Today's show was brought to you by Migrants Organise, a platform for refugees and migrants to organise for power, dignity and justice to enable meaningful inclusion and integration. They combine advice and support for individuals affected by the hostile environment immigration policy with community organising, advocacy, research and campaigning to dismantle structural racism. The theme song for this episode is Conform or Be Cast Out by Of Moy Om.